Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, legendary podcaster, actor, writer, director, comedian, Ricky Gervais. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Welcome to a, I've said this before. I always say, oh, this is a special podcast. This is a meaningful one for me. People ask me who's on my list of people I haven't talked to, who I've wanted to get in here for the podcast. Ricky Gervais at the top of that list. Absolutely has been for several years. I've been such a huge fan of his work. Of course, going back to The Office and Extras, those two in particular, such classic, influential pieces of work that influenced all of pop culture, but certainly my own work certainly has been impacted very much by his embracing of the awkward, his embracing of extras of skewering celebrity. His just no holds barred approach to comedy is something I really respect. I think he is just he's not a triple threat. He's a quintuple threat or something. He can do everything so well. So I was so thrilled to have him on the podcast. I actually had an opportunity to spend a bit more time than even on the podcast with Ricky this past week. I did a Q&A with him in front of an audience for an event promoting Afterlife, his new show on Netflix. And then Ricky was kind enough to come in for a long conversation here, and he was a delight. I should mention his new show, which is getting some really great reviews. It's getting a tremendous response. I really enjoyed it. It's called Afterlife. It is currently available on Netflix. Just 6 episodes. I just plowed right through them. Honestly, I just binged them. It was not a chore. It was something. It was a delight. It really was. It's an odd show in that it sounds on its face to be kind of dark and depressing. The premise is that it's about a guy dealing with loss and grief. He has just lost the love of his wife. But he kind of takes that that horrible event and uses it as an opportunity to just sort of say and do anything and just be kind of like the unfiltered version of himself. And therein lies the comedy. But it is also truly emotional and moving at times. It's a really unique blend, and certainly something that in some ways moves Ricky into areas he hasn't explored yet, and in other ways calls back to the emotion and comedy that was even there right from the start in The Office. So check out Afterlife. It is on Netflix right now. I highly recommend it. I'm not going to say too much more because the main event today really is this conversation with someone I so admire. He is one of the funniest men on the planet. So why waste time with my prattling on? Here he is, the one and only Mr. Ricky Gervais.
I'm eating those grenade bars too now.
Yeah, they're so I don't snack on rubbish when I'm hungry.
No, me too. But then I eat like 5 of them.
I know, it's a fault. I'm like, it's still slightly better than...
That's how I rationalize it until horrible form of cancer derived from grenade bars comes at me.
I know, yeah. You never know, do you?
Something
get hit by a bus, you can be lovely and healthy.
Exactly.
Some people turned down the pudding on the Titanic.
You could be hit by a bus full of grenade bars.
And exactly. It could all just the irony?
A confluence of events.
Lovely. Like a poem.
Exactly. As you can see, this is super cash, sir. Thank you so much for coming by.
My pleasure. We started.
Why not?
Hard to tell.
It is hard. In these weird podcast times that you really created these, it's your fault for the podcast.
Yeah, but I feel like I've come for a job.
Yeah. So where's your resume?
This is just his office, and he's stuck up two mics, which is, that's all you need. I mean, I'm not being funny about it, but it's a bit odd.
It is a little odd.
We're also very close. We're leaning into the table.
You're leaning
it's
in.
It's like we're going to do an arm wrestle.
That's the end of the podcast. It's the last 10 minutes.
Exactly,
I hope you've been training.
Yeah.
Well, we used to do the podcast. There's literally a studio through this wall. That's a more conventional studio.
Right.
And yes, the sound quality is probably 20% better. But it just feels like this is home for me. And sometimes if I don't know the person, this gives them a sense of who I am.
Sure.
And it's a little bit of a shortcut
it's a
to
power,
familiarity.
It's a power thing then, isn't it?
It's totally a power move.
And you give me a lower chair and there's a light shining in my face. Yeah.
You'll find the chair also lowers very subtly throughout
every 5 minutes. I feel more and more inadequate. Great. Come on in. What have you got for me?
I have nothing. We had a blast the other night. Thanks again for spending all this insane amount of time with me. But it's all for a good cause. We're promoting your wonderful show.
And it was actually lovely. I sort of dread those events. And then the crowd were amazing. It played well. You were great. The questions were great. It was like, I always feel slightly guilty that I ever worry about those things because they're always okay. But it's because when I put something in, like 3 weeks' time, that's 3 weeks of me thinking I'd rather be sitting at home in my pants drinking wine. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If they just, we're doing a thing, I go, okay, if I'm there anyway, it's over with. But it's the
anticipation,
angst.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm definitely going to be having to, I'm going to have a choice to do something better that night, and it will be sitting at home in my pants drinking wine. So yeah, everything has to compete with that.
So the secret is really just to book you like with 30 minutes notice. Then you're fine.
I guess so.
Super chill.
Jump out. I mean, I was lazy when I was poor, so imagine what it takes now to get me out of bed.
Were you? Okay. Well, you're in a good mood, and rightfully so, because the reception's pretty great.
I've never had a reaction like this. And I don't mean just reviews and, you know, friends and all that. I mean, the Twitter reaction is insane. I literally can't keep up with the tweet. And Humanity was good, but this, I think this is like 5 times the traffic of Humanity. So I don't know what that's a reflection of. I assume it's a good marketing, the fact that, you know, Netflix send out an email, they get, you know, 150 million people get it in their inbox.
Yeah.
You know, and the front cover. So for a few days, I'm like Google. You've got to see that word Google. Whatever you went to see, you see Afterlife on the Netflix page. And so people go, oh, I'll give it a go. And then they binge watch it. And so the model is incredible. The Netflix model is incredible. I mean, it's still got to be good.
I was going to say, you actually have to deliver.
You have to deliver. No, you have to deliver. Yeah, so... But I think the traffic, you know, assume what you do is, you know, good enough for people to watch. The traffic's been insane because of the success of Netflix, you know, and social media. You know, I don't know what it had been like with The Office, but it wasn't around then. But I think it's more a reflection of it's that binging plus Netflix, which is the internet, plus social media.
Yeah.
It's been insane, yeah.
Do you feel like, I mean, do you steal yourself before, like, a big launch like this? And I know these shows that you self-generate yourself and that they're so much your baby are very important to you, needless to say. But, like, there's baggage, good and bad, that goes with everybody's name, and especially your name. I feel like people come to your shows and your all your whatever you do with preconceived notions.
Yes. I agree. More than anyone else I know, any other comedian. It's like... it's odd. Whenever I do a sitcom like this, which, I mean, it's not a traditional sitcom, obviously. It's a you know, comedy drama. But it's people... They seem to judge me against... one person, when Extras came out, one journalist said, this is sub-Dickens. And I think, well, why are you judging me against Dickens?
Everything sub-Dickens?
Exactly. Yeah, isn't... That's a bit unfair. So, yeah, people come to me with... I I hated him in The Office, or I hated his stand-up, but I'll give this a go. But as I look at these tweets, and I try to like them all, and I've even liked tweets that said, I hate Ricky Gervais, but this show's really great. And I think it's like I'm...
That's a major endorsement in a way.
Well, and it's like I think I'm training them.
Okay.
I'm giving them positive feedback for being nice.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Ignoring them if they're... So...
you just imagine them on the other side looking at that being like, what?
Isn't he like that? Yeah. it is nice to view what people are thinking and saying. But, of course, it's nicer when it's all lovely.
Yeah.
You know, if there were snotty ones, or, you know, even 50-50, you right. think, you remember the 50 that didn't like it,
right.
you know. So this has been pretty unanimous, more so than anything I've done, actually.
And just to give a little exposition out of the way, so the show is Afterlife. The premise it seems to be very dark, and it is very dark.
It is very dark. No, it is very dark. And the premise is it's uncompromised and obviously a dramatic story, slightly high concept. So it hits the ground running. You see my wife on a laptop that I'm watching in bed, looking pretty sad. And she's going through chemotherapy. And she says, if you're watching this, I'm not around anymore. I couldn't say any of this to your face. Too embarrassing. Not for me, for you. Not for you, for me. Yeah, you were never any good at hearing how nice you were. And then she said, but you're absolutely useless. And she leaves a guide of quite mundane things like when to take the bins out and, you know, how to fill the dishwasher and change the salt. And it's quite sweet because so you know, I've lost my wife. She was the love of my life. She's being stoic. She cares what happened before she dies. And I'm a broken man. So that's it. And so the high concept came to you. Imagine you lost everything. What would you do?
Right.
And he decides... first he decides to kill himself, but the dog's hungry. So he feeds the dog, which I think you would do. I certainly would. And that gives him long enough to think. And he says, OK, I'm going to do this living thing for a while at least, but I'm going to punish the world. I'm going to punish the world for this. This is unfair. And I'm going to start saying... and doing exactly what I want from now on, because I've got nothing to lose.
Right.
And he treats it like a superpower. He says, you know, I've always got... I do what I want from now on, and then I've always got suicide to fall back on. So it is very dark, but there is comedy in that for two reasons. I think, one, we live vicariously through his freedom. We all go, I wish I could say that. I haven't got the nerve or something. You know, the mugging scene. Right. We hand over our money because we don't want to get hurt, or we've got a baby in a stroller, or they know where we live. He says, I've got nothing to lose. Bring it on. So it's that sort of freedom. And I think the other part of the comedy, where all comedy comes from in sitcoms, even one slightly strange, is it's usually an ordinary guy trying to do something he's not equipped to do.
Yeah.
That's what we're laughing at. And what he's trying to do is become a bad-ass psychopath.
Right, which is against his nature. It's not him.
He can't do it.
Yeah.
He can't do it because, you know, if you look back, once you've seen the whole thing, you look back and you realise that actually he was nice to the vulnerable people. He was nice to his dog, his nephew, the old lady in the graveyard who was kind to him, the new girl who was, you know, scared and in the headlights. He's naturally a nice, caring person still.
Yeah.
So you can't pretend to be a psychopath if you're not one, amongst other themes in it. And it basically asks the question, if you lose everything, is life still worth living?
Right.
That's the question it asks at the first... few minutes of the show.
It must be a different kind of a satisfaction you get from something like this versus, like, you know, you can make people laugh.
Yes, it's exactly right. I should be able to make people, that shouldn't be a revelation. People saying you're funny, I should go, well, I should be, because I get paid an awful lot of money to be.
Right.
It's like saying to a doctor, oh, you know what that rash is? And he goes, yeah.
Well, I went to school for it. Kind of.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, when they say it made me cry, that means a lot to me. When they say I was crying and laughing, that's the best. And that's by far, I think 95% of people have said that. One minute I'm crying, one minute I laugh, which is great because that's what life is. And, you know, fiction is real life with the boring bits taken out. So it's right. Turbo. He's really sad and he's really rude. And, you know, you really laugh and then you're really sad. And so I am very proud of that because it's slightly more ambitious than I've done before, yeah. I think. It is. And I think what's weird is, all you have to do is just be honest. It's not. There's no secret to it. There's no revelation. It's just I decided to, as I got older, just be more honest and braver. And I think most people start off with good intentions, like, I'm going to do an uncompromised thing, right?
Right.
And then someone interferes and goes, oh, you know, you'll get less viewers if you do that on the posters and that. Or, do you really want to say that? That's a bit... And it's soon it's watered down and it's like everything else, right? And they think, what happened there? And and it's because we second-guess people. All the things that I deal with in this show is what everyone deals with every day and talks about and jokes about and celebrate. Right. But when you send the jokes, go on and tell you, people go, oh, can people take it? I want to go, well, of course they can. It's happening in their real life. Why couldn't they watch it on the telly?
Right.
And that's what's odd to me. The people go, yeah, no, it's really good. It's really true to life and everything, but shouldn't put it on the telly. Why not? So that's madness.
What do you think enables you to go to these places or want to go to these places that most people don't? I mean, could you...
Because it's like I don't patronise the audience.
Yeah.
I've seen the future. I know they can take it.
Right.
Because I can take it.
Right.
And we have conversations about these things every day and everyone can take them and everyone's grown up about them. It's like in my stand-up. I deal with taboos for a reason. I want to take the audience to a place that hasn't been before. But as soon as people hear the subject, they think, well, this is a comedian, so he's making fun of something, right? As opposed to thinking, well, it depends what the target is.
Right.
And I've heard people on posh podcasts and radio shows discussing whether Ricky Gervais should joke about that subject. And I go, well, you're talking about it.
Exactly.
And that's what I'm doing. I'm just doing it in a funny way and a bit quicker than you.
Right.
So comedy and art and everything, it's a discussion. It's just a disguised discussion. You know, people ask me why I did things. And I go, that's what I thought of doing. I've no reason of doing these things.
Right.
People say, well, why did why did you give the drug addict that money? Well... Because it seemed like a more interesting story than not giving him the money. It's like,
yeah.
That's my thing. If you don't like it, you've got to write your own drama when you don't give the drug addict the money. That's what I want to say to people.
Yeah.
I liked all those jokes. I didn't like that joke. Well, you've got to write a different one and you've got to do that. You've got to make... Because that's what I'm doing in fiction. I'm perfecting the world. The scene with the children's menu, that happened to me in real life.
Right.
And in real life, when she said, you can't have that, it's on the child's menu, I went, oh, all right. So 25 years later, I can go, no, this is what I should have said. Right.
Have you always had a... Is it fair to say you've been preoccupied or not preoccupied with death, mortality? Is that something that's...
Yes, but only in a comedic way, not in a real way. I've luckily never suffered from... fear of it or any sort of depression, and it is luck. I've always known it was the biggest taboo, so I've always talked about it. And I think I've given reason that I'm an atheist, so I don't fear death because I think it's the same as it feels the same as before I was born.
Right.
So there's nothing to fear.
You won't know any better.
Exactly. You don't. Exactly. That's the best thing about being dead. You don't know about it. It's like being stupid. It's only painful for others. So there's nothing to fear. Right.
Fear pain. Fear
dying. How I die. Yeah. I don't want to die in agony or, you know. Yeah. Of course not. Or found in a wardrobe wearing ladies' tights.
In pain, combining
it. Nitrate orange in my mouth. If that ever does happen, I'm not into that stuff, so one of my mates has stitched me up.
Oh, good.
If you find me in the way, you go, well, Ricky's told me he doesn't do this stuff.
Code orange, go.
So one of his mates has done this, and they would. If you know my mates, they probably would do that to me. They would love me to be found like that. I'd die peacefully in my bed, in my sleep, and they go, let's dress him up and put him in a wardrobe.
Have you thought? Because I had Fred Armisen in here, and he's already intricately planned his funeral. He wants it to be very scary.
Yeah.
He wants it to be creepy. Organ music, everything.
Yeah. I don't care, obviously. The only reason I like to think it would be a nice funeral and people were crying is because that means there's people around now who like me.
Right.
So that's it. I can't. No. I think you should have. I think everyone should have one funeral when they're still alive.
Oh yeah.
Do the funeral when you're still alive. Just make it like it is, and you're secretly watching. You hear about it, and you go, yeah, so that was nice.
So we should look out for the first announcement of Ricky's death. Yeah. That's just a fake out.
I mean,
out.
Not a lot of people get that big. Well, no one gets that big day. They know you get that big day, dead.
We deserve that big day.
And I do not mean this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I've told all my family that individually that I'm going to give them my whole fortune. Right?
Oh no!
Yeah,
that's going to be a little disappointing for some, more than it.
It's going to be a fucking bloodbath.
It's going to be Game of Thrones style.
I want people to like me now. Yeah.
Yeah. But it amuses you to know that in the future they will kill each other for your vast fortune.
I don't care about the look on their face when I leave the money and I'm dead. That does me no good at all. So
it's a clerical error. I meant to
exactly. Yeah.
Did your parents live to see your success?
No, not really.
Yeah.
They still liked me.
You were
my dad saw my mum saw I think the pilot of The Office, mm-hmm. and she didn't make it to. And then my dad saw a bit of The Office, and he went.
Would they have been shocked, you think, to see this trajectory in the last?
I think it would have blown their mind. Although, I don't think they'd have been. They'd have been. I'm still their kid, and I'm still my sister and brother's little brother.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean anything. They're not going. It's it's like. I don't go home with any attitude or airs and graces.
Right.
You know, I know my place. It means nothing in a way.
Because one of the fascinating things to me is like, so when The Office hit, you were what, roughly around 40?
Yeah, 39,
right? So like it feels like to us that didn't know you, and most people didn't know you. You kind of came out fully formed.
Of course,
it was like this guy. Who was this guy?
Well, that's very true, and it sort of didn't. And for a couple of reasons. One, I've always done that. I've always people watched. I've always played around. I've always done impressions of people to make kids in the class laugh at the teacher and my family. Impressions of I've always done that. Right. Social satire. When it's saying it came out fully formed at 39, like it was my first go, it wasn't.
Right.
I've been honing my skills like anyone for, 40 years nearly.
Yeah.
You know, from year dot, I was like that. And I was thought of that like comedians. There's that thing, some comedians have funny bones and some have to work at it. Right. And I always thought, I've got funny bones. But actually, I don't know. Because when I started, because I was late, I had been working at it in pubs with mates and at home. So I don't know that that's, I like to think I've got funny bones.
Yeah.
But because I started so late, it's like doing exams in your 40s. It doesn't really count. I know I could pass all my exams and do my degree.
Right.
But it's like, well, you should... So a comedian that starts at 18, that's why it takes them 20 years to be funny. So starting at 39, you have got a little bit of an advantage.
You know,
you're aware of your own inadequacies. I was already getting fat and old. I had a perspective. I had a voice. I had a confidence. I had the audience thought, well, this bloke's lived a bit.
Yeah.
You know? So I think all those things look like I came out of nowhere and got it right first time, but not really.
Well, and I was surprised to see that, like, again, looking back, immediately preceding The Office, and correct me if I'm wrong, like, it wasn't like you were completely unknown in where you were. Like, didn't you have a chat show that you had just done?
So my first thing, I worked in an office for 10 years, which is what The Office was sort of based on. And so, I must have been taking mental notes. And I'd done David Brent as one of a few characters I did. I got a job on a sketch show, characters for a comedian in Britain in about... 97, I was on the radio around the same time, being funny on other people's shows, just turning up like I just worked there, and I did just work there. I wasn't a DJ. I was worked in the office. I went from one office to another office. It just happened to be a radio show.
Right.
So I popped up. I was meant to be writing them things and doing stuff for them and the news, and I said, oh, it'd be easier. My laziness. I went, I'll do it. Because I couldn't be bothered to type out things for other DJs. So I went, I'll just pop on. And I popped on, and I was funny. And it sort of built. And I always said, don't introduce me as a funny guy. Say the guy who works upstairs.
Right.
So I always knew about that Trojan horse. And I got a call from a new show in about 98. While I was still on the radio, I only did that job for about a year. And it was a new show called The 11 O'Clock Show. Now, what it was like was sort of SNL, but off the charts. Like, the things they spoke about, swearing. It was just, honestly, it was like they let teenagers take over television for half an hour. And it was everyone's least favourite and favourite show. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was that bunker mentality, you know. And I did that. And the first thing I did on that was, because it was a fake news show, I did a reporter that got caught up in the story and started to editorialise. So I'd come out, and it was real stories of the day, and it would be like, nurses have gone on strike today for extra pay. And then I'd go, don't get me started. Nurse, what are they... And I'd always get it wrong. I played the sort of pub or right-wing sort of bigot.
Right.
Before we found out that half the population were exactly like that.
Well, that's that unfortunate twist in 2016 or so.
And so that was the gag, really, that, I mouthed off, and I shouldn't have been. I was the wrong person for the job, and I was sweaty in a bad suit and unshaven. So that was the
and that people responded to that?
Yeah, and they did, you know. They were saying... And I remember thinking that the whole show was shocking, but sometimes I went in the studio with the presenters and I told the presenters to be shocked at what I said. So it looked like I was the most shocking.
Right, on the already shocking show.
And I wasn't. it was like a marketing tool.
Right.
Just like I walk out of the Golden Globes and I pretend I'm a bit drunk and I might say the wrong thing. I've written the jokes. I know exactly what I'm going to say. It's marketing, you know? So that was it. And then they offered me my own chat show, which was a sort of spoof chat show where I was still the wrong person for the job and I was meant to interview celebrities.
Right.
But I'd accidentally insult them or it'd be more about me.
So playing a version of yourself.
A version of that same guy.
Yeah.
Who went for the reporter to get his own chat show, and he was bullish and you know, accidentally insulting. And
did you enjoy that?
I did enjoy that. Yeah. It was my first thing, and I stopped that because The Office was about to go into production. And that wasn't because I was too busy. I thought it would ruin The Office because I wanted The Office I didn't want to get too famous.
Yeah.
So I wanted The Office for people to
think... People to buy that this guy was...
For 1 minute, they thought it was a fake documentary, and we cast all unknowns. Now they're not unknowns either, obviously.
Right.
And, you know, in fact, by series two, you're not unknown. But at least you get that project out of the way before you confront it. So that's the very fast trajectory.
I'm curious, in the intermittent years, have you ever been approached for... talk shows? Like, have you been, like, off?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Like, here and in England, yeah. This is the internet. Here, I'm in America.
Here in my office.
I'm in New York when I say here. Yeah, yeah.
That's not intrigued you, though, to try your hand at, like, a broadcast or cable,
no, because,
like, late-night show?
No, I mean, I did this job so I didn't have to sit behind a desk and work
every
five,
day. Yeah.
5 days a week in a suit. Maybe one day.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what I mean, it'd be fun, but it's not what I do best.
Yeah.
It's not quite timeless and definitive for me because you have to churn it out. And again, as I say, throughout my career, my laziness has been mistaken for integrity more than once.
when I was looking back down the internet rabbit hole about you, I was reminded of an infamous conversation you had with Gary Shandling.
Yeah.
So what happened there again?
Well,
is that because for people that haven't seen it, it's a very awkward seemingly conversation.
Yeah, I find it hard to talk about because. I don't think he was feeling well.
Got it.
At that time. I'd say that. And he's talked about it since, and he's been very gracious and said, oh, we tried something, it didn't work. And what he said was, because he'd invited me to talk on his DVD extra about Gary Shandling because he knew I was a fan of Larry Sanders. Sorry. And I said yes. And I said, oh, and I'll interview you. And he said he came in and he thought he was we were doing his thing.
Right. You were both coming at it from your own shows. Yeah. And there was a kind of a strange...
Yeah. And that might be true. It might not. Mm. But I still... I put it in and I celebrate it. He tried some things and he... And, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you said kind things after he passed,
and
I know.
I was still here. That wouldn't affect me. That wouldn't... I wasn't one of those people that said, "Oh, never meet your heroes."
Right.
He's still a genius. He was still lovely, and off air he was lovely and talking about, you know, he just tried something that people thought, "Oh my God, they hate each other," which just isn't true.
Right.
It was just, you know, a thing that he was doing that. Yeah,
got it.
Yeah.
I know we're bouncing around a bit, but
sure.
I'm kind of fascinated by like sort of the. Because I was a fan from the start, at least from the start when The Office hit, of sort of the trajectory your career took in terms of acting. Like,
yeah.
it felt to me from the outside looking in that, you know, you had this amazing opportunity, like your profile just like exploded, and then for a second or two, you kind of played the Hollywood game or kind of like, I'll play in their sandbox a little bit.
Although I never did really. I think people thought that because... after The Office, I think the first thing I did was I popped up in three episodes of the biggest movie franchise ever,
right?
Which was Night at the Museum. Now, that was me returning the favour for Ben Stiller doing extras.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that was. And then I did one. Then I said, they got two. You got to go, all right. And I remember, and I loved doing it, and it was fun. They said, your scenes are with Ben. And I remember cutting every appearance. I cut it down to 2 days at the weekend because I was doing something.
Right.
But of course, you pop up in a film that makes $1 billion, and it looks like you're everywhere.
Right.
And you know, so that was never the intention. My first film that I took, I was offered a film when the second episode of The Office went out. They called me from Hollywood and said, well, I said, who's the lead? And they said, you are. I went, who's going to go and see that? And I said, you want John Cusack? And they went, oh, OK. Now, I put the phone down and I thought, that'll show integrity. Now, what they probably thought was, what an idiot. What an idiot, turning down a film. But, JJ offered me, JJ Abrams, he loved The Office and he got my email and said, come and do Alias that was on. And I did an acting role and I haven't watched it. I loved Alias, but I haven't watched me because it was my first role being serious. And it's not my... I get no joy about seeing my fat face on telly or film. My joy comes from coming up with the idea and building the thing. And then he offered me a part in Mission Impossible. Then he offered me a part in Star Trek. And I was busy and it's not my thing. So for all the things I've popped up in, I've said no to 50 times that. But it still looks... The first thing I did that I was committed to, and I thought, no, this is a good thing, and this is that it was written for me, and I thought, if I don't do this, I'll never do a movie, was Ghost Town.
Right.
And so, still not mine, though.
I
still don't count that as my movie.
Yeah.
Even though we sort of collaborated, and he let me do, you know, and, you know, I was my first lead in a real Hollywood film with one of the greatest writers, and, you know, I still don't count that as mine.
Yeah.
That was it, really. I can't think of any. What else did I do?
Well, those are Stardust. You did a little thing with Matthew Vaughn.
Oh, again. You know, a friend and just said, come on. I said, yeah, you know.
You could still be running around the world watching Tom Cruise hang off planes to this day.
Well, that was what my fear was. If I took a big role in a film that wasn't mine, I have no say. I'm in my Winnebago for 7 hours a day, and then I pop up and do one thing, and they go, oh, we've lost the light, I'll see you tomorrow. And I go, I can't. I finish at 4 when I'm filming my own. So it is, it's partly, I'm only excited about the creation of it, partly I'm a power freak, and I can't sit around and not be in charge, you know, that drives me mad. Partly I really do get no joy about seeing my fat face unless I've created the thing.
So there hasn't been, like, an opportunity, an audition, a thing in, like, the last 5, 10 years that you've really kind of, like, wanted to put yourself out for?
It's just no, it's just all the time. But not because... Listen, half the things you get offered aren't very good.
Yeah.
The half that are good I'm still not excited about them because it's not mine. And then, am I busy? Am I doing something better? Why would I... I did the Muppets again. Mm-hmm. I love the Muppets, and it's a friend. James Brown was a friend, and I thought that'd be fun.
Right.
And it was in London, so it was here. So I honestly do think, how hard is this going to be? I was offered the Winston Churchill role, and they badgered me for ages, and I kept saying no. Even my agent was saying, it's going to be a great movie. And as Jane pointed out, I'm playing a 62-year-old Winston Churchill. She said, you'll be in makeup 3 hours a day. And I went, yeah, correct. No, definitely not. But my main reason was, I'm not the right person for the job.
Right.
There's better people to do that. There's people who love dressing up and doing voices and being in character for years. I'm not one of those people.
Yeah.
I want to start writing my next project or going on tour. You know, this is my...
Well, you're spoiled in a way, in a great way.
I know.
You've created this amazing infrastructure where you can, thanks to all the great work you've done, you have this creative license now, and you have the outlet with Netflix. It's sort of like, fuck this up?
Yeah, there's nothing I'd rather be doing. You know, my favourite films of all time, if they said, you've got to do this, but you can't do this next project, it's no.
Right.
It's no. If it's easy and down the road and, you know, yeah, why not? But I honestly... I don't care for that. I don't care for that sort of...
You've kind of imitated the model in a different kind of way, and his name is now, for reasons like taboo to talk about, but like Woody Allen, who I know was like an influence for you growing up. He was a huge influence to me.
Yeah, well, I thought he was. I remember seeing Play It Again, Sam. I just thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen him. The wrong person, the putts. And also in Annie Hall, when he was making her laugh and she laughed, I thought, that's new, because usually they're sort of above the comedy in a movie.
Right.
Like, they're saying funny things, but they're not laughing. It's like they don't know they're being...
Right.
And I took that and I did it the other way. I did it with David Brent when he thought he was funny and he wasn't. And
right.
You didn't see that happen very often either. Like a joke falling flat. You know, like where everyone in Friends is funny, handsome and funny all the time.
And there's no acknowledgement of it. Just move on
to the audience are cracking up because they're witty. Whereas what if someone isn't witty, you know?
You'd actually be pissed off at your friend, be like, I just said something really funny, actually.
Yeah.
Could you?
Yeah. So, he was not my biggest influence. I'd say maybe people like Christopher Guest.
Yeah.
That to me is a sublime... I don't go and see comedy films because I can't take the risk. I think, why? Why'd you do a film about... It should be funny all the time. There's funnier podcasts than, you know... But there's 10 exceptions to me. Spinal Tap, a couple of Woody Allens, you know. And then lately, Airplane, Team America. I just thought, right, OK, that's...
There's something about that absurdist broad comedy that often will last longer in some ways. Like, there's something just so instinctual about Airplane, I feel like.
It's crazy. And it was new.
Yeah.
It was new, and it was so dense and fun, just funny, funny. I love things like The Simpsons and Family Guy. Again, it's funny. It's funny.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't sort of see the point of going to see a wry comedy or a knockabout comedy or an amusing romantic comedy it's not essential. And also now it's not essential to pay $20 to go to... It's like Netflix have sort of... Again, you know, if you want to get me off the couch watching Netflix, this has got to be a major event, you know.
Sure.
Or I'll watch that film on a plane.
Yes.
You know, on a 4-inch screen, as the director intended.
As Christopher Nolan always imagined.
But yeah, I've got nothing. It's all personal choice. And everyone's the same. It's just that people like me don't usually say it. Like, I'm doing my thing because that's what I like doing. I am spoiled. Every I want to have fun every day.
Yeah.
I don't want to not look forward to 1 hour of one. I don't. It makes me angry.
I loved what you said the other day at our Q&A when we were talking about people like cracking up on set, and you're like, "Why get mad at that? We're actually." You're laughing doing your work.
You're at work. Think of a job, any other job, when you can't do it because you're laughing.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get away with that in a hospital. You can't do your job because you're laughing so much. Well, you're fired. You're fired.
That patient
was very offended, yes. You know? It's like, what a joy that is. And that's exactly it. When I'm doing my thing and I've surrounded my friends and I'm making them laugh and being paid... There's nothing I'd rather be doing, even though I still stop at four because I want to get home and get on the couch with a glass of wine. So I want it all.
Yeah.
I want to create this. I want to wake up in the morning and go, I've got an idea. I want to do that idea. I don't want to outstay the welcome. I want to be at home and I want to have a real life. And I never forget real life is more important either. I never forget that. I never say this is going to be traumatic, but it's going to win an award. I go, it was an award.
Right.
You can't sell them; they're not worth anything. You know.
Yeah, I've tried.
I know that real life is more important.
In this bizarre age of like quote unquote cancellation culture, are you kind of shocked that people haven't tried to cancel Ricky Gervais?
Well, like, I'm sure they have. I'm sure they've started it, but. Unless you break the law, there's nothing anyone can do. If I make jokes that people don't like, their only form of protest or censorship is for them not to ever watch me again.
Right.
And I'm really happy with that, you know? And they can try and stir up stuff, but, you know, it's when you say a comedian gets in trouble, again, if he hasn't actually broken the law and done something, they're not in trouble, they're selling more tickets. They're selling more tickets by people being outraged. So no, it annoys you at first. Then you sort of embrace it and use it. You know, I sometimes go looking for trouble because I monetize it. I sometimes tell trolls that they've just made me about $200,000 with that tweet because I'm going to say that on stage. It's 5 minutes. I'm going to play to 800,000 people, and then it's going to be percentage. Of,
my accountants have cracked the numbers. You've literally just made me
exactly. Yeah. So no, it doesn't bother me. I'd never be upset by that. I've never been upset by anything on Twitter. I've never. I mean, if someone libeled me, I'd probably say but it's got to affect me in some way for me to even care. And I mean, the John Wayne thing recently was
Playboy interview, right?
Nearly a spoof. The fact that this man, 48 years ago, in Playboy magazine, we're talking, right? Not unearthed. It went out at the time. It's been around forever.
Right.
It wasn't found, right? Wasn't woke enough. Said some awful things. But this is 40 years after death. So people, when he was trending, right, saying, this is terrible, he's a racist. I want to say, he's a dead racist. What do you want us to do about it? What can we do about this? And I think that's what virtue signaling is, really. These social justice warriors sometimes, what they're doing is they're finding something that's bad and they're telling the world they're not like that.
Right. It's about them. It's about separating yourself from...
Yeah. And there's some great spoofs now on Twitter. Titiana McGrath and Jarvis DuPont that are really out there social justice warriors who... That, honestly, they're the funniest tweets you'll ever see.
Really?
Yeah, because just being those people from cancel culture who are outraged by everything. Honestly, I couldn't do them justice, but your listeners should check them out.
Do you talk about this kind of thing with, like, friends or comedians? Like,
This
has to be the talk in all the rooms right now. Where it's Kevin Hart having to deal with this stuff. And
again, the Kevin Hart thing. So, 10-year-old tweet. They were pretty silly and shitty and boring and, homophobic. Yeah. And he apologised for them and he'd never done it again.
Right.
But then 10 years later, he has to keep apologising for it. And he loses him a job, So, and my point about that is, if you have to keep apologising for things you did 10 years ago that you don't do anymore and that you've already apologised for, there's no value in improving. He might as well do the tweets again.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So where is this forgiveness? Where is this you know, I'm not a Christian, but I do like the let those amongst you who aren't sin cast the first stone. I mean, that's a great, that's probably my favourite thing in the Bible. And people forget that. People are hypocritical. Oh, they go after, they want blood. It's schadenfreude, it's crazy. And I talk to other comedians and they all agree with me. Some of them don't say it because they don't want the flack, but they agree with me. And you know what's most hated in the comedian fraternity? The comedians who join in and try and get someone cancelled. They are pariahs.
Traitors to the
cause. Whether they know it or not, they're hated more than the person that did a bad thing,
right,
or said a bad thing.
We don't want to end on too serious a note, so our relationship...
We're going to play a game now.
Our relationship began with Fuck, Marry, Kill, Ricky, as you may recall.
Still my favourite. And I love how worried everyone else was who did it.
So yeah, for context, for those that haven't seen it, it still exists on the internet, as everything does. We played Fuck, Marry, Kill at the Night at the Museum, the third film, I think, Junket. It was you and Ben.
It was very uncomfortable.
The juxtaposition of your reaction, which was pure joy, of these very inappropriate Fuck, Marry, Kill questions I asked about Teresa and Gandhi and Martin Luther King. That was one scenario.
Hitler was in there.
There was Hitler, Mao, and
Stalin.
Stalin. Yeah.
The big three.
Yeah. and Ben. Oh my God. Poor Ben Stiller.
He actually said, "I'm not comfortable with this."
No.
Right. Yeah.
What happened? Do you remember what happened after I left the room? Did he just say, "That's my day"?
I think he laughed.
I'm done.
I think he laughed.
Okay. Good.
I think he laughed. At one point, I was acting out. I was saying, "Go back and kill Hitler," and I said, "No, I'll go back and change Hitler." I'd go back and hug, and I'd hug him, right? And I hugged Ben, and he went, "Wait, am I Hitler in this?" I went, "Yeah." He went, "Oh God, come on."
We've since made up. He was here for the podcast recently. He's lovely.
He is. It's great.
Would you rather be 2 feet taller or shorter, Ricky?
Do you know what? What's really weird is I did a really exaggerated version of this on my podcast.
Did you really?
I did. I asked. I've done a thing with Ashley Jensen because in Extras the thing was she kept asking me, "What would you rather do?"
Yeah.
And it got on my nerve. And so I turned the tables and I've asked her, but the most banal, weird ones. And I asked her, "Would she rather be 10 foot or 10 inches?" And she said 10 inches. And I was going, "No, it's 10 foot." I was going, you get trodden on with 10 inches.
You're going to last.
She went, where would I get my clothes? I went, "Where would you get your clothes if you're 10? At least no one would take the mickey out of it if you're 10 foot. You'd be like Game of Thrones. You'd be going around crushing cottages.
You would be a multimillionaire in the NBA. Yeah.
Okay, so 2 feet taller, that makes me 7'8".
Okay. Or 3'8".
7'8". I'd be 7'8", because I'd be a basketball player or something,
yeah,
wouldn't I?
I think that's more practical.
So it's basically NBA or pantomime.
Your buddy Warwick, talk to him about that. Would centaur or merman? Would you be a...
Is the centaur the...
I think it's half horse, half...
So it's a horse's body in a man's face.
Yeah.
I'm not a merman. I've got a... No. So I'm basically a fish with a head or a horse with a head. So basically what you're saying is, what would you rather be, a horse or a fish? Well, a fucking horse. Of course.
I didn't know it was such a no-brainer. Okay.
Yeah.
Would you rather be reincarnated?
I don't know why mermaids are considered sexy.
No, yeah, I agree. I'm with you.
A siren.
No.
Because you look at the head and go, "Oh, nice face." And then it's nice, like,
"Oh, twist."
Oh, what
twist.
The fuck? Where do I start?
How does this work?
I know. Although it's still better than the other way around.
Is it though? I mean,
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can do your business.
You're thinking,
but you have to face the head of a fish.
It would have.
It's like the fly.
You'd have to do it in the dark, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pitch black.
I know. Yeah. I'm getting nervous about taking this conversation too far. So I'd be the horse running at 45 miles an hour with my little head. Think of me going down the high street. Morning, it's Ricky. He's going at traffic, just going over cars. It'd be great.
Yeah.
Just
yeah. Would you would you rather have uncontrollable farts that never smell?
Yeah. Oh.
Or
there's no point. There's no point in that one. It's the second one.
Or uncontrollable smelly farts that don't make a sound.
That one.
Okay, so you want to just, like, emit really horrible odor, but no one hears it. So
yeah. I want to annoy people, and they don't even know it's me doing it. That would be a superpower
for me. That's your Marvel hero?
Would be a superpower. Just people throwing up, like, so bad, like a sulfurous methane, that when they go, and they instantly vomit, and I pretend to be vomiting. Right. I'm going, who's that? Who the fuck was that? Right? And it's like, it'd be amazing. I'd clear out the queue at Pret a Manger.
Right.
And I go, spend the queue. It would be...
You've really looked at the bright side of this.
It would be amazing. It'd be amazing. Yeah.
Do you own any color in your wardrobe? Is it literally all... Like, if I opened up your closet...
Yeah.
Is there a flash of color? Is there a yellow, an orange, a pink?
There might be a little bit in some suits that I don't wear anymore because I can't get into them. all my T-shirts are pretty much black or grey. There might be a navy blue one.
Do you have a stylist? Have you ever had a stylist?
Fucking hell! Did you manage to say it with a straight face? I can't remember. Oh God! Jesus Christ! The stylist, yeah. Oh, that's amazing. When I do a show, the wardrobe, the costume person, they try and get me not to wear a black T-shirt because they also know that I'm only doing it to keep the clothes after. So there's no coincidence that Derek was tracksuits and cardies, and there's no coincidence that Tony in this one was jeans and grey and black T-shirts. Listen, who cares? I like to be comfortable. I don't look good in Armani. There's no point. So I look
shit.
But
don't bring Armani down.
I mean any Paul Smith, Armani. I'm never going to look good, right? So I'm going to be comfortable.
Right.
I'm going to look shit whatever I'm in. So I wear tracksuit bottoms. So who am I trying to impress?
Yeah.
I had people on the red carpet that was interviewing me. Right. I was up for a Golden Globe or Emmy a couple of years ago for Derek. And they were laughing at my shoes because they were too comfortable. Who cares? Those camera people like Ryan Seacrest getting the camera to look at my shoes, thinking, what is this? Is this not a fashion show? There was a big thing when our Prime Minister was Gordon Brown. There was a big thing in the paper, like, oh, look how scruffy he is. Good! He's a fucking Prime Minister. I want him to be scruffy.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Yeah. Don't spend 10% of your brain on your appearance.
I want him to be worried about the state of the economy.
Just like a homeless man. I want him to be...
Yeah, I don't want him to do in his fucking hair.
I really think you might have cracked the code to life. I feel like you... Forget Oprah. You know how to... I don't know, you've cut through all the bullshit.
Yeah.
And you've learned how to be a happy person.
But I did that, I worked out about 14. They don't have to go around the houses to be happy. What makes you happy? Just do that. Just do that straight away. Cut out the middle man.
There you go.
Yeah.
Life lessons from Ricky Gervais. truly an honor to have you in here, man.
That was a pleasure.
I'm such a fan of your work. Everybody should check out Afterlife. It's on Netflix. You have no excuse. It's in a gajillion homes. It's right there waiting for you in your box in your living room. But it's honestly a great piece of work. I really enjoyed it. I mean, just not to go down a dark hole at the end, but like I literally had just had like a very sad, untimely passing in my family when this came into my email box, and it was a wonderful laugh over 3 hours, but it was also a cathartic kind of an experience for me. And I know a lot of people are feeling similarly.
Oh, thank you very much. Cheers.
Thanks, Ricky, as always.
Cheers, pleasure.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.